The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Very few people really enjoy travelling on planes, especially on long-haul flights, but would you be willing to stay on even longer to cut fuel emissions? Scientists have said that reducing speed is one of three bold measures that the aviation industry could take to reduce fuel burn and therefore emissions. I'm joined on the line by Kevin Byrne, retired Lieutenant Colonel and airport and safety and security expert. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, what do you think of this idea of slowing it all down to save fuel?
It's a strange one, and it triggered a memory from my time in the Air Corps when they used to go off on maritime patrols. I was sitting in the right-hand seat of an aircraft, small little King Air, with a pal of mine who later became a chief pilot in a certain Irish airline. But we were cruising at 240, and he leaned across and throttled it back to 200. And I said, why are we doing this? And he said, what we get now is extra endurance. In other words, the fuel will last longer in the aircraft. We're not in a hurry. We don't have passengers on board. And therefore, an add-on effect, he said, by the way, is we get an extra 20 minutes on our logbooks. So the flying time increases because they got paid flying pay in that regard. Now, that might not work in the commercial world because, you know, as I said before, the low-cost carriers and indeed many carriers need to get so many flying hours per day per airframe. And they do that in many ways by doing a quick turnaround, 25 minutes at every airport they go to all over Europe, North Africa and so forth, you know. So you've got a knock-on effect then. Do you have why would you rush then on the ground if you're going to extend the flight time by maybe 50 minutes on a flight to New York from Europe? And then why would you bother being in a hurry on the way back? The problem with that is, too, you add the flight time to the airframe hours. In other words, you're going to add 40 minutes or 50 minutes or an hour per airframe flight. And you're also going to have the problem of rostering crews because you don't want them going out of hours before the flights or the two flights or whatever flights they're doing are finished. So there are implications and as regards the ground operations and the flight operations. So it's a great idea in principle, but would it work in reality, as Gareth Fitzgerald used to say?
So if a 737 on Ryanair is flying maybe six legs in a day, and then you reduce its speed by 20%, it means that you're going to only fly five legs or maybe even only four legs, depending on all of that. Yes. And that presents a massive problem. You may end up with an aircraft in the wrong place.
Yes, indeed. Or you might say, let's bring it back, but then you're extending the flight day of the particular airframe. Do we let the aircraft fly earlier in the morning or later at night? And you know there are implications for that even now in terms of, curfews at airports and that kind of thing. So you are assisting the emissions and reducing the fuel burn, etc., but you're having an implication for the ground and other operations. And then do you want people who want to fly in at midnight? Most people don't like landing at airports at midnight. I can see why. And then do you actually need more crews? Do you need more rostering of airframes to produce the results that you get now by flying at the prescribed cruising speed?
And then you mentioned the airframe earlier, but also the engines. They have mandatory servicing intervals and certain things
absolutely
that have to be done. So the aircraft, given that it's flying longer every day to go long haul, is going to reach those servicing points much quicker, I suppose.
It is, and there are all of these implications. You know, one off, you've got to pay one off against the other. It's a very finely tuned machine at the moment. If you mess with one of the component parts, you have to look at the knock-on effects elsewhere. And, there are simple things that can't be done, as you say. If we can't fly 12 or 13 hours a day, long haul is even more complex because, you know, you have to have the aircraft on the ground for so many hours and that kind of thing. You may miss your slots as well because you'd have to rejig many of the airports which have slots. Restrictions. Even Dublin now is going to have to restrict the number of flights it has. So there are implications as regards timing, parking aircraft on stands, all that kind of thing, even refueling them and how much fuel you carry. So there's an implication there. Not a bad idea, but it's not as easy as it sounds when you've got one particular type of aircraft, like Ryanair Fly, for example. You know, I flew from Kerry to Dublin on a 737. They use the same aircraft type, perhaps later in the day, to fly from Dublin to Tenerife or that kind of thing. So there are implications for all of the operations.
Now, the question of the stall speed of an aircraft, I mean, up at 30,000 feet or whatever, the air is thinner. Therefore, to get lift, you've got to go fast. So if you slow down, are you in danger of losing lift?
You are to a certain extent. But as I said, we were cruising at 240 knots. Throttle back to 200, said, now we're only at 17,000, not a big deal like that. But at 15,000 feet, there's about half as much oxygen as there is, you know, at higher up like that. So the higher you go, the thinner it gets. At 35,000 feet, you have to be going pretty fast to to keep a weight of an aircraft, say 120, 150 tons, in the air. You can throttle back so far, and it won't affect, you know, the volume. It'll affect the volume of lift, of course it will, but it won't affect the efficiency really. But there is a speed. I remember watching a TV program about the thing called the U-2, which was a spy plane, still in use, by the way, at 70,000 feet. And the pilot was saying, look, we've got 5 knots between our cruising speed here, which is Mach point, whatever it was, Mach 0.8, and stall speed. And if we stall, we're going to fall for a long, long way before we can get lift again.
And, of course, so one of them did famously crash over the Soviet Union. Was it Gary Power was the famous
yes,
U-2
it was.
Pilot?
Yeah, who was CIA pilot, and the man survived to be killed later in a helicopter accident in Los Angeles. Can you believe that?
Oh my goodness. Now, the things that airlines can do, I mean, obviously the more modern aircraft is more fuel efficient anyway with new engines, and new materials might give us lighter airframes.
They do, yes. The 737 Dreamliner, about which we've spoken a few times, is remarkably light and quite, you know, flexible in that the wings bend a bit more, you know. And aircraft will get lighter and lighter. But there is a limit, of course, because you have to balance lightness and weight against strength. And, you know, you want an airframe life of maybe 30,000 flying hours or whatever the figure is agreed upon. You want it to last 20 years anyway and get your money back, because they're not cheap to buy, as you well know.
We had Conor McCarthy from Emerald in the other day. You know, they operate Aer Lingus's regional services.
Yes, I do.
And
he
was talking about the progress that will be made in terms of SAF, the sustainable aviation fuel.
Indeed,
and someday there will be hydrogen, perhaps, if they can overcome the safety considerations. But one of the things he said is that aviation gets a bad rap because the IT industry globally has more emissions attached to it. Even landfill, he said, has more emissions attached to it than aviation. So, you know, what is it about aviation being pointed at all the time? A bit like the farmers, I suppose.
It is. And I mean, last week we had a lovely ridge of high pressure over the land, you know, and I saw in the sky, which was, I guessed over Nace, it was a very big, fat airplane. I got my little laptop out and had a look at it and said, flight radar said it was a 747 of cargo Lux flying between Los Angeles, LAX, and LUX, Luxembourg, a town I know well. And it was carrying over 120 tons of cargo, you know. So it's a very efficient way of doing it, and it's fuel efficient. But you could see it, and it left a trail that was about 6 or 7 kilometers long, and it took a while to disperse. So there were about 10 trails in the sky over Ireland on that particular day in the east here. And I can see why it's a soft target, even though less than 2.5% of the pollution of the world actually comes from aviation. And it's going to get less as we head towards 2030 and to 2050.
Now, you're talking about cargo overflying Ireland, that from LAX to Luxembourg. One of the cargoes that we're concerned about is military, either personnel or munitions that might be using Irish airspace. Is there any way of knowing for sure what is overflying us?
Yes and no is the answer to that. I hate to be, you know, dichotomizing. But look, on a flight plan form, whether it's done electronically, which they all are now, you know, or it's repetitive or whatever it might be, there's a little box, and you can put in there, if it's a military flight, M. So if it's an air cargo company supplying, you know, services to an air force, let's pick an air force, any air force, it should be M, even if it's a civil registered aircraft. But you've no real way of checking that. Another point about the distinction of airspace is, the vast majority of traffic, 85% or even 90%, as someone mentioned recently, from Europe to North America, flies to Irish-controlled airspace, but not necessarily over the territorial airspace, the sovereign airspace, which is vertical limits, unlimited, in fact, above the land area and the sea area. So it's our territorial waters vertically to space, because no one has agreed a top level of the airspace, as it were. And that's ours, and you shouldn't go into that without permission. But you can go around it, and you can take services from air now of Ireland, which of course provides the service and makes a steady, handsome profit on it. So 85% of traffic to and from the USA goes to Irish-controlled airspace, but less than that goes across our sovereign airspace. But there have been examples in my time where aircraft, you know, did or didn't get permission. One day I got a call when I was working in Baldonnell, and they said, have you got binoculars? I said, I do, because over Meath, this gentleman said, there are three B-52s at 15,000 feet in formation. And they said, understood why. One of them sprang a leak, and instead of going around Ireland, going into RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire, they asked permission to go straight in, and they went over Dublin. Three beautiful. I didn't see them, but they must have been a very spectacular sight, just 15,000 feet. That's probably 25, 30 years ago now. So things happen. But if you want permission to carry, you know, munitions, hazardous or, you know, other cargoes of a military nature, you are supposed to fill in a form, go to the Department of Foreign Affairs and ask permission. But I'm sure some cargo companies don't know that, or they don't bother with it, or somebody says it's all right, you don't have to.
Is it a very expensive diversion to avoid the island of Ireland plus 12 miles of our official limit?
It'll cost you a bit, but I mean, if somebody else is picking up the tab for the cargo on board, it's a very minor diversion and you'll have it on board. You know, you should know it before you depart this, either from the States to Europe or wherever it might be going. But I've seen aircraft on radars which have diverted, you know, off the Cork coast and then into Land's End and that kind of thing, deliberately to avoid the need to fly through Irish sovereign airspace. But these are people who know the rules. But as I said before, we've got problems with some of the reservists in a certain air force who hop on board. In one case, they brought an aircraft, not a transport aircraft, a C-130 Hercules. It was a gunship version, and they came for the weekend down to Shannon and left it on the ground there. And there was a giant cannon sticking out and two heavy cannon as well. So you could see from the ground this wasn't a transport aircraft. But these were reservists. There were Air Force people who flew at the weekends, didn't understand the implications of neutrality or the need to ask permission. So they were told to get out of the hotel and get the aircraft off the ground in Ireland, which they did quite quickly.
A question from one of the listeners. Do lighter aircraft, lighter airframes mean more turbulence?
Yeah, good question. And the answer is generally yes, but to be honest, the difference between, you know, a 50-ton and a 100-ton aircraft, if the turbulence is severe, which we have discussed on the program before, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I was out of Hong Kong, I told you before, on a 787 Dreamliner, last aircraft in a tropical storm. Magnificent turbulence. The aircraft was literally being bounced around the sky, wingtips bouncing up and down. I thought it was spectacular up the Pearl River Delta, but a lot of the passengers were white-knuckle riders, you know, that type of thing. But it didn't. It would affect an aircraft weighing 30, 50 or 150 tons. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Mother Nature is remarkably powerful where it comes to light aircraft or heavy aircraft.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us. Kevin Byrne, retired Lieutenant Colonel, Airport Safety and Security Expert. Thank you very much. Now, coming up next on
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.